Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome. Good afternoon. Thanks for being here. I am Regan McMahon. I'm the book editor at Common Sense Media, which is a nonprofit website that helps families and educators navigate the world that media and technology that kids live in. As terms of announcements, I guess the only thing to say is, if you haven't already silenced your cell phone, please take a moment and do that. And at the closing, we'll have a time for audience Q&A towards the end. And also after all that, out in the lobby, it says the lobby, but it looked like it was actually on the street.
Yeah.
It's on the street.
Yeah, it's actually going to be to the left of the entrance.
To the left of the entrance, as you go out, you will see all of Nina's books for sale. And so she will be signing books, and you can be buying them. Nina, as you probably know, is the author of four critically acclaimed young adult novels, 2009's Hold Still, which won the Northern California Book Award for Children's Literature and was named an American Library Association Best Book for Young Adults, 2012's The Disenchantments, which made the 2013 Young Adult Library Services Association, or YALSA, Best Fiction for Young Adults list, 2014's Everything Leads to You, which won the ALA's Rainbow Project Award, and 2017's We Are Okay, which won the Michael L. Prince Award, the ALA's top national young adult fiction award.
Yay.
She also co-wrote with David Levithan 2016's best-selling You Know Me Well, and has contributed to several YA anthologies, including 2016's Summer Days and Summer Nights, 12 Love Stories, and a whopping three this year, Meet Cute, which came out in January, Our Stories, Our Voices, which is coming out in August, and Dear Heartbreak, which will hit stores in December. It doesn't sound very cheery for Christmas.
It's true.
Thank you for being here, Nina.
It's so nice to be here. Thank you.
First up, let's talk about winning the Prince Award, which is a really big deal. I guess you actually received the award at a ceremony in June in New Orleans when they went at the big ALA conference. How about if you tell us where you were when you heard the news and tell us how your life has changed since that day when you got that call in February?
Well, it was a Saturday, and I was home alone. My wife and daughter were running errands, and my phone rang, and it was an unknown number, I saw the number, but it was unknown to me, and I answered, and I was on speakerphone, and it was a big group. It was the whole committee, and so what happens is the different committees for the American Library Association meet throughout the year. They correspond throughout the year, and they have all of their books that they're considering, and then they meet at the midwinter conference to choose a winner. And so it was the whole committee on speakerphone, and they told me who they were, and I started to cry. and then they called the winner and the honor books, and then they told me that mine was the winner, and then I started to cry harder, and just kind of proceeded to cry throughout the entire phone call. And I promised them that I would be more coherent when I get to meet them in June, and so I have to deliver on that promise. I have to give a big speech, which I have not yet written. And don't really know what I'm going to talk about yet, but I have to come up with something good. Mm-hmm. Since then, I don't know. I wouldn't say that my life has changed. I mean, I've been a little bit busier, doing more events. But I think that it's just kind of given. It's like this once in a lifetime thing that you can only dream of receiving if you're a YA writer, and so it's just kind of been this incredible experience to have received that kind of validation from my work and to know how appreciated that novel was. And the novel means a lot to me. And so to have it, it felt like it was my best work. And then to have a committee like that recognize it, it was just, it's like life altering in an internal way, I would say. And it's something that I know that I'll hold with me forever.
Has Hollywood been calling or anything because of it?
No Hollywood. I do think that career-wise, like, it's definitely going to open doors for me. I'm working on some new projects. I just finished a picture book manuscript, which is my first picture book. Oh. And I think that kind of everything that I do now will be kind of, my agent will be able to go out with it in a more exciting way, having that title under our belts.
Mm-hmm. Cool. How did you get the idea for We Are Okay, and why do you think that this book struck such a chord with readers, critics, and librarians?
The idea came to me slowly and in different pieces. So I had been really interested in writing a story that took place over a very short period of time and that didn't move around very much. I have written like a road trip book or a book where like a mystery through Los Angeles and Hollywood, books that really have my characters going from one place to another. And I actually feel very... like, those kinds of books are exhausting for me to write. I hate getting a character from one place to the next. And I remember, like, when I was writing my second book, The Disenchantments, I found myself thinking, why did I get myself into this? Like, it's a road trip novel, which means everywhere they go, I have to establish a new scene, like, a new setting, new characters. All of that, like, hard work of writing, I had to do over and over again. And so I think part of it was just, like, laziness on my part. I wanted to just, like, stay in one place. But I also love when that happens in books and films. One movie that I really love is Pieces of April, and it's all like in this character's apartment while she's making Thanksgiving dinner, and it takes place over the course of like one day. And so I like, you get to see things in that film that you don't get to see when characters move around so much. So for example, there's a lot of emphasis on these little like turkey salt and pepper shakers. And I just loved the idea of being able to do that. So I knew, you know, timeline, I knew that I wanted one setting, but that's certainly not a story. It's just a concept. And so I was just kind of waiting for the right story to come along. And my grandfather passed away, and he was someone who, as many of you in the audience know, was a really special person. And so during that time, excuse me. So a little while after that, my wife had this great idea. And she said, hey, why don't you write about a girl who was raised by her grandfather? And I thought, you know, that sounds great. That sounds like characters I could get behind. And she said they could be like in Ocean Beach in San Francisco, which is a neighborhood that has meant a lot over the years. And so I thought, yeah, okay. So then I had characters and I had a situation, and it still wasn't a story. And so then I really had to wait and wait and wait until the right story presented itself. And the story that came was like nothing like what I'm sure she imagined. My grandfather was a very sweet man and very uncomplicated as far as I know. And this turned into a very complicated kind of darker story. But the love was there and those characters were there. And so I just had to wait until piece by piece it came together.
Mm. You grew up in Moraga, and you worked in bookstores in Moraga, Lafayette, Oakland, and you went on to tutor and teach and be a guest lecturer at Berkeley City College, right down the street, Maybeck High School, Stanford, and Mills, where you received an MFA in creative writing in 2006. You lived in Oakland for several years, and now you live with your wife and daughter in Martinez. How has the Bay Area influenced you in your work, and do you consider yourself a regional writer?
The Bay Area has been very instrumental. I should admit, I only guest lectured at Stanford once, but it looks really good on my bio. So, for everyone who's wondering why I have Stanford on there. The Bay Area is so ingrained in who I am. We recently, my wife and daughter and I recently had this idea. It was spurred on by me that we would move out of the Bay Area, actually, to Nevada City area, and got really far along, got our house on the market, and then I was like, what are we doing? Like, take it off, never mind. So I think I'm just kind of coming to terms with the fact that I'll probably always live in the Bay Area. And every book that I've written, except, I guess, For Everything Leads to You, has taken place, at least partially, in the Bay Area. And it's just kind of the way that, it's completely shaped my worldview. And so I can't really, I mean, it would be a real effort to set a book completely away from this area. And even in We Are Okay, so much of it takes place in upstate New York, but it's like within a dormitory, so I didn't really have to learn anything about it.
When you were growing up, were books a big part of your life and your home? And how did you get turned on to writing? And when did you know you were a writer?
Yeah, books have always been a huge part of my life. I mean, when I think about like the apartment that I grew up in, I think of a bookshelf, like two bookshelves that sat right next to the dining room table. And throughout dinner, I would like stare at the titles, and sometimes they would come up in conversation. And I'm lucky enough to have parents who read to me all my life and who encouraged my own storytelling, and a series of teachers along the way who encouraged me to write too. And so I can't really imagine life without books. I spent countless hours as a kid alone in my room reading or out on the couch reading. I never did like organized sports or activities. It was like me and a book or a pen mm-hmm. and a notebook. And I'm really grateful for that. I think that reading so much kind of led to a rich like interior life, I guess. And I observe things really closely because of the way that I see life reflected to me from the page. And so I just think I think reading is a great joy. I can't imagine life without it.
Mm. Did you have a particular teacher who was a significant mentor and made you feel as if you had something special and you could do writing as a living?
Yeah, I had a few. I think the one who stands out the most, though, was my senior year in high school English teacher. His name is George Hegarty, and that was the first year when I was in high school that I was able to write a short story for an English class. And I actually asked him for that assignment. I said, we haven't gotten to do any creative writing in high school. I really would like to write a short story. And he was like, great class. Like, we are writing short stories for our next unit. And that was really powerful. And then, and I just remember, like, he has this like very neat little handwriting, and I remember at the end of my short story, like, he had nice comments throughout, and then at the end he just wrote, "You have a gift, George," and I thought, okay, you know, I'm gonna keep doing this, and it was really special, and we're still in touch, and he lives in Oregon now and still teaches high school and has assigned some of my books in his class.
Oh,
and,
wow!
Yeah, so that's been really special.
Oh, that's cool. Can you tell us what led you to become a YA author and what the special joys and challenges are of writing for a YA audience?
Yeah. I went to Mills College for grad school, and I had been working on a novel for adults, and that's what I got. That was my writing sample to get in. And then I just found, as I was writing, that novel was really challenging, and I think, you know, I was still, you know, very young, like in my, like barely 21, and I was trying to write this really kind of sweeping multi-generational story, and I think I just didn't have the life experience or perspective yet in order to get it right, or the confidence at least. And so I kept trying, and I kept feeling like it was not going anywhere. And I remember, like, the process of writing that novel was so agonizing. It would take me just hours to get out a couple of sentences, and it was just so hard. And then I took a creative writing, young adult literature class with Catherine Reese, who's a great writer with a really long career in children's literature. And as an assignment, we started a novel. And so I kind of mined some high school experiences and started writing a novel. And suddenly, like, it just flowed out. It was this kind of joyous experience of writing. And it was just the opposite of what it had felt like to write that other book. And so I felt like this is, you know, that was clearly what I was meant to be doing. And so I set that adult novel aside and focused on the young adult one. And it was my thesis. And then it turned into my first novel that was published. And then, since then, I've gotten to work with this amazing editor named Julie Strauss-Gable, who is kind of she is definitely like a superstar in terms of children's literature. She's also John Green's editor and a lot of other really high-profile authors, and she's just brilliant. And so it's been such a joy to keep working with her. And she's believed in me a lot and has given me contracts for new books all the before I've written them or conceptualized them. And so that's led to a really nice career in writing for YA. Mm-hmm. But I am also working on that adult novel again now, so many years later. I can't even tell how many years I've been working on it. But it's coming a lot more easily now because now I'm 35 and not 21. And so I understand a little bit more about the world, and it's working out.
When I spoke with her about you, and she said that it was an easy decision for her to give you your first book deal, because she said her Nina's work is deeply empathetic. She understands other people and gives them the space they need, and she's that way with her characters. It takes a lot of craft and consciousness to leave room for the characters to breathe. And I just wanted to ask you, what does it mean to have empathy for your characters? And wouldn't every author have empathy for their characters?
Well, first I'll say that I love hearing that because Julie actually never says anything nice to me. Whenever I hear about nice things that Julie has said, it's always through other people.
Oh, like, that's funny.
She'll stand up and give like talks at library conferences and say like glorious things about me, but she'll never say those same things. So anyway, that was lovely. I'm just soaking it up. Let's see. So I had this wonderful professor at Mills College named Yoon Lee, who's an amazing fiction writer, short stories and novels. And she put it so well. She just says, you have to love your characters, and even your characters who do horrible things. And she writes about some really transgressive behavior, like in a way that's like not morally redemptive to most people. And yet she says, I love them. Like, this man can do like the most horrible things imaginable, and I still love this man. And I think that that's just a good way to think of it. So I think that, you know, most writers would have empathy for their main characters, or the protagonists, the people who are helping their characters out. But it can be tempting to put a villain in, and that villain can take many forms in a novel like I write. I think in Hold Still, I had probably what was closest to a villain, just as like the mean girl in high school. And I don't think that I ever really redeemed her. It's interesting, I should go back and look. But I did not love that character. And so I imagine that she's a pretty flat character compared to a character that hopefully I would write now, where I feel like I have kind of internalized that, and I understand that the world is full of people who butt up against us and who do things that we don't agree with, and yet they're doing it out of some inner place, and I don't have to love that place, but at least I can find it very interesting and experiment with that on the page.
Mm-hmm. One of the things also that Julie mentioned to me was that when you did Hold Still, which is a novel that deals with teen suicide, that you did that at a time when very few other authors were dealing with that. Now it's become, you know, there's been a lot of books about that. But what inspired you to take that on?
I mean, personal experience, I had a boy who I went to school with through middle school and then the beginning of high school, and he took his life when we were freshmen in high school. That same year, my middle school science teacher also took his life. Oh. And so I just kind of confronted that as a freshman in high school. And I remember, of course, the shock of it and the sadness. I still think about the boy who I was friends with, and not close friends with, but who I spoke to on a regular basis. We had classes together, and he was a really special, charismatic, talented boy. And so I think it was kind of when I started to write about high school, that's what came up. And I think it was also a very sobering time in terms of understanding the limits of adults. Because I remember at school, teachers didn't know how to talk about it. I remember a lot of silence around it and a lot of stigma or shame. And maybe it felt like shame, but it was really just adults not understanding how to help students because they were as lost and sad as we were. And so all of that kind of comes out in that book.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering when you write novels about teen and young adult characters, you know, how do you how do you approach getting the right voice, getting the that young person's voice? Are you drawing more from your own memories and your own experience of being a teen, or are you observing the way teens today talk to each other, or what?
I have not been observing how teens talk to each other. I feel like the least connected to a teen experience right now than I have been, you know, since I was a teenager. I think I taught high school for several years, and so I was around teenagers all the time then. But I haven't been, and it's actually interesting because my work is, they're all getting older, and I haven't set a book in high school for a while, and the current project that I'm working on has a very different tone, and she's nowhere near high school. So that might just be kind of the natural evolution of what I'm writing right now. But even when I do try to think about a teen voice, I never make an attempt to kind of to like capture the way that I would hear a teenager talking like on the corner or something like that. I feel like if I'm not speaking that way, I think it's going to ring false. Even if I get the words right, it's just going to feel inauthentic to me. And so I tend to just have my teenagers talk the way that I would talk, or another person, adult or teenager. If a certain voice comes to me, it's not like a teen voice, it's just a person's voice, and that person happens to be a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I actually think, you know, like there is a lot of talk about like, how do you capture the teen voice as though there's one teen voice, and it's not everybody speaking the way that they speak, you know? And so I just kind of trust that if I'm writing from an authentic place and not trying to, you know, create like a caricature of a teenager, then it'll turn out fine.
Mm-hmm. Your books feature gay characters, but your focus has not been coming out stories. And a member, I think I've shared this with you before, but a member of YALSA's Best Fiction for Young Adults committee told me, here's another quote about you, said, Nina LaCour is excellent at what I call LGBTQ 2.0 stories. 1.0 is all the coming out books. 2.0 is when you get characters who are queer, but it's organic, and the drama is in other aspects of their life, not their being gay. So can you just share what your perspective on all that is?
Yeah. I mean, there are many coming out novels in YA, and for a long time, I think that was really the only time you would have a main character who was a queer character, was it was a story of coming out. And I think that those are incredibly important. I was just in Texas on a panel called Reading the Rainbow with David Levithan and Melinda Lowe and a bunch of other, Julie, how am I forgetting her name? No, not her. Julie Murphy, of course. Julie Murphy, who I adore, and who wrote a really good kind of nuanced look at bisexuality recently. And it was this like huge auditorium full of teenagers, and they all like came to this, you know, like, from the Dallas area, and all of them had questions about coming out. And so I think that it's not true when people are saying like, oh, we don't need coming out stories anymore, because we absolutely do, because that's something that all of those teenagers wanted to know how to do. But that's just not where, it's just not where my interest in writing a story has been. And I think that also for teens who are looking for books about queer characters, it's important to not have that be like the only story. You know, there's life after coming out, there's life before coming out, there's life without even thinking about coming out. And so that's kind of what I've been providing.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's kind of a dumb question, but I'll ask it anyway.
No dumb questions, as I would tell my high school students, yes.
In telling stories involving gay characters, do you ever feel any pressure to have them be good role models, or are you free to have them be as flawed and complicated and complex as anyone?
That's such a good, it's a good question. Yeah, I think that right now we're so lucky that over the course of just the last few years, the novel is about LGBTQ plus people have just multiplied. So before there were only a few, and now they're just kind of everywhere, which is fantastic. And so I think that in the beginning, there may have been a responsibility to be like, I'm going to provide these readers with these mirrors that are really positive, you know, and so that they'll read a book and they'll be like, this girl is like me, or this boy is like me, and that's important. And I want to see like the goodness in myself reflected. At this point, though, now I think that there is enough that we can write flawed characters or evil characters, and that's great too. And a novel that I just finished that I really enjoyed was Melinda Lowe's new novel, and in that it's a murder mystery. Well, it's a thriller, I should say, and most of the girls are queer characters, and one of them, I mean, they all are kind of complicit in committing a very serious crime. So I thought that was great, you know, that we can see that. It's called A Line in the Dark. It's really good.
I don't know how much feedback, direct feedback you get from your readers, but I wondered if you have if there's any memorable feedback you've gotten from readers, gay or straight, that, you know, like, oh, I'll never forget this letter that somebody wrote me, or...
I've been so lucky to get so many of them, and it's always really wonderful to read them. It's also been really cool because for Hold Still, I would get so many letters that were depression or suicide related, and that was so heavy and, of course, very important, and I was glad that people were reaching out and talking to me and that they had found some comfort in my novel, but it was also... You know, it's not exactly fun to get a letter about, you know, suicidal thoughts or the loss of a friend, and I would have to put a lot of thought into my responses, and they meant a lot to me. But now I've gotten to get all of these letters that are like, my girlfriend loves your book so much, will you sign it to her and like send it to her for her birthday? And I've gotten to do a few things like that, and that's just been really fun to see that people are feeling, you know, affirmed by the stories that I'm telling. And of course, I still write about serious topics, and so I still get serious, weighty emails, and I appreciate those very much too. But it's been great. I guess the one that's coming to mind that's really memorable was this whole birthday plot that I got to help with, and to get this girl this romantic birthday gift, and that was fun.
How has being a mom changed how you view your characters, if at all? Are you more protective of them? Do you want to make sure they put on a coat when they go outside?
I found that I've gotten... Well, there's the YA writer, Stephanie Keen, who is also a local writer. She writes about these horrible things that happen to teenagers and that teenagers do. And I remember asking her once after a panel, like, aren't you somehow afraid that, like, by writing these horrible things, they're going to happen to your children? and then I was like, that is such a weird question. And, like, no, she doesn't need to be afraid. And that had never crossed her mind. But there, I do have like strange irrational fears like that, like, and that I have to kind of push aside in order to write the books, the stories that I want to tell. And I think that part of writing is exploring those kind of fears that we all have or struggles that we have. And so I, you know, I will make my characters endure really sad things, but I do, like, it does hurt me to make it to make them do that a little bit more, I think, since becoming a mom.
How about I really like in Are We Okay? I mean, We Are Okay. I really liked the flashback scenes of, you know, to like what happened to her in high school and at a party and this and that, and I thought it was very fluidly done the way we'd go back to flashback. And you know, I was wondering if you might ever have flashbacks that go back to very young childhood, so that where the character might be the age that your daughter is, and so you could kind of translate that what you know now of the little kid experience and have that in a book somehow.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I haven't quite thought that far back yet. Like, I'm just thinking about the book that I'm currently working on. It does go back to younger childhood than most of my novels have, but not quite that far. But I mentioned that picture book that I wrote, and that was, you know, directly inspired by having a young child. So I do think that it's opening new doors for me in writing.
Hollywood, I mean, I know I already asked you, you know, if Hollywood had come knocking at your door, but this question is that Hollywood, as we've observed, seems to love YA books now. I mean, it seems like they don't have any ideas of their own, and they're either going for sequels or for YA books to turn into movies. Or, of course, there's always superheroes. Is it hard not to let the idea of your story becoming a movie someday creep into your consciousness as you're writing? Like, are you secretly fantasizing about a certain actor portraying a certain character or anything like that?
I think I used to be much more than I am now. I actually don't think about it now at all. That might be because I've had so many friends whose books have turned into films, and it's certainly not as glamorous and wonderful as it seems. It can be huge struggles. It can be really unhappy. They have to pretend that they like it even if they don't like it. You know, I think it can be a very excruciating thing as well as an exciting thing. And so I really don't. I'm very kind of immersed in the story right now, and like in just the storytelling and not really thinking about the film versions. And, you know, that can ebb and flow, of course, but I think that right now I'm happy to just kind of be pleased with what I have going. Yeah, and I've completely lost track. I mean, I do know some of the big stars right now who are teenagers, but I haven't been following super closely, and so I don't know. But if I did ever have a film version, I would love to have some unknown actors in it, because I think that sometimes these teens or, you know, young actors, they appear in, like, they're like the YA actress, right? And so they'll appear in like every YA movie, and then I think it's difficult to distinguish one character from the next.
Sometimes people really like when they have an author, have access to an author in a setting like this, to find out some of the some craft questions and sort of the writer's life questions. And so, do you have a writing routine? Do you write every morning? Do you write at home? Do you write in a cafe? And how has being the mom of a young kid changed your writing routine?
I have always craved a routine, and I've never, ever had one. And I love hearing about people's writing routines, and at readings, I'm always like, when it's time for questions, my hand always shoots up, and I'm like, tell me about your writing routine. And or like, do you have a ritual for writing? But I have not been able to ever get that, even before being a parent. It's eluded me. And so I am just learning to go with that and try to use it as a strength instead of a disadvantage. And I will write whenever I have time. And sometimes I'll go really long stretches of time without writing. I also teach in a graduate program, and so sometimes that work is what I use my, you know, few hours a day of work time doing. And then I have to try to leap back into a project. And so I write at our local cafe, I'll write at the kitchen table, I'll write on the couch, mornings or evenings or whenever I can. And I always hope to write on a more regular basis, because I do find that it's helpful. If I write every day or close to every other day, I don't have as much of a period of time that I have to spend when I'm slipping, trying to like reacquaint myself with the story and trying to get back into that mood or that scene. It just kind of helps me, you know, dive right back in if I'm doing it regularly, but I have yet to achieve that. I hope that once first grade begins with, you know, the full school day hours, that then I'll be able to at least write 5 days a week.
You've been a writer and a writing teacher for a long time, and as you say, now you're in that program, which is the creative writing at Hamline in Minnesota. What's the best advice you ever got as a writer, and what key advice would you give writers just starting out?
I don't know. What's the best advice I got as a writer? I'm blanking on that one. I feel like it's funny saying it coming from the perspective of a creative writing teacher, because I do, like, that is what I do. But I feel like writing really is something that you have to figure out for yourself. And you have to figure out what works for you. And there are so many rules that can be discarded. And I just think you just have to, like, do it and trust in yourself and find your own voice, and not try to sound like anybody else. And also, don't be afraid if you do sound like somebody else for a while. I mean, I was obsessed with Raymond Carver's short stories when I was in high school and early college and just studied them. And my early stories, like, are like a ripoff of a Raymond Carver story. Like, it had my own characters and situations, but, like, I was just studying him, you know, and that really showed in what I wrote. I remember a friend gave me, like, a story that her boyfriend had written, and she was like, "Isn't he such a good writer?" And I was like, "This is like Virginia Woolf, like this is a Virginia Woolf riff-off. And it, like, yeah, he is a good writer, you know, but it's like we all start somewhere, and so that's fine too. I think that's totally part of the process, to find writers that you really, who speak to you, and figure out how they do what it is that they do. But in terms of just like a writing life and sustaining a writing practice, I would say having a writing group is really important. I am lucky enough to have been working with the same group of women who I met at Mills in grad school. We've met every month, and I'm trying to remember when. So we graduated from Mills in 2006, and we've met every single month since then. We all used to live in the Bay Area. For a while, one of us lived in the Philippines. Now two of us live in Oregon, and two of us live here, and we still do it, you know, like with our computers set up. Like, we'll each go to the other person's house and set up the screen and eat dinner all together and have our writing group. And it's just really great to have people who understand the, you know, specific struggles of trying to be a writer and trying to make it and trying to constantly produce new work or send out old things that haven't found homes. And then also to have people who know your writing so well that you can read them new stuff without feeling like you have to impress anybody. And having people who you know will say, "This isn't working," if it's not working, and push you to, you know, try something new.
Mm-hmm. What mistake would you urge a writer starting out not to make?
I think that, I mean, the times have changed so much, which they have. but I know that for, like, tons of young people who I meet who are, you know, teen writers or writers in their early 20s, I think it's so easy to publish things now, like publish things online or self-publish. And I feel like people are publishing before they're ready, and there used to be this, you know, like the gatekeepers in publishing, which is not always a good thing, of course, and a lot of voices haven't been heard because of that. But I do think that there's something to be said for, like, honing your craft and really editing and waiting until you have something that's really strong, and then going through this process of trying to find an agent and a publisher, trying to find an editor and a magazine who will publish you. I think that people who kind of, you know, finish a first draft and then say, "All right, it's done. Let's, like, you know, hop on Photoshop and make a cover and then, you know, put it on Amazon." Like, I always feel like, no, don't do that. You know, and be patient. It takes a lot of patience and a lot of disappointment and rejection and time in order to get something that's ready to go out in the world and be a reflection of who you are.
How much rewriting do you tend to do?
I definitely rewrite. I write very slowly. I think that people usually fall in one of two categories. People either write many, many, many words and then cut a lot and change a lot and revise a lot. And then there are people who write slowly and few words and kind of revise as they go in an excruciating manner. And that's my mode of writing. And so I do a ton of revision as I'm writing. And then I usually do, like, one major round of revisions with my editor, and then just kind of small things after that.
Mm-hmm. The YA fantasy writer Maggie Stiefvater, I don't exactly know how to, is that right? She said that her measure of success was, quote, "publishing books that made readers want to read her next one without knowing what it was about." What's your definition of success for yourself?
That's something that changes over time. Success is like such an elusive concept, and I just have watched just with myself and with friends, like, that at first success can be finishing a story or finishing a novel. Like, that in itself is a huge success, and then it can be finding an agent for that novel, and then it could be finding a publishing house for that book, and then I think it kind of can spiral out of control and be like, then it's selling a certain number of copies, or then it's getting a next book deal, or then it's getting on a bestseller list, and it's a difficult thing to rein in sometimes. So I think that there are also different stages of success. So for me, like, having a good writing day where I write, you know, enough words that I feel good about them, and I see that this project that I'm working on is moving in a positive direction, like, that's great success. And I feel like that's actually the most satisfying kind of success. And then having a full project take shape is also success for me. Like, I do now believe that I can do it again, like, write another novel again, but it took a while for me to really have that kind of faith in myself, that it wasn't just like a one or two or three time thing, that I would keep having ideas. And so every time that happens, that's definitely success. And then having it, of course, speak to people, reach readers, and get recognition for it is kind of, I think that's like the extra, it's like the bonus, but not how I want to measure success for myself.
Mm-hmm. How much do you enjoy playing with form? Like, when you did your collaboration with David Levithan, and it was like, I mean, maybe you can describe that process for people.
Sure.
Because we had the alternating narrators.
Yeah, so David Levithan has written a bunch of novels on his own that are really wonderful, and then he's co-written a lot of novels, and so he asked me to co-write a novel with him. And how that worked was, we came up with a very one really inciting moment, like, these two teens meet at San Francisco's Pride Parade, and like, then we had to come up with a story. And so he wrote his chapter first, and he revealed who my character would be, and then I wrote my chapter, and then that's how we wrote the whole thing. So it was completely blind, and we would just wait till we got the next person's chapter and then pick up the story from there. It was very fun. It was also like so different from the way that I actually write all of my books, because I don't write from beginning to end. I skip around within a manuscript, and so to have to change my process so dramatically and have no control over where the story was going was very different for me, and I had to end up just kind of treating it as a fun game that I was doing, and let go of that control that I usually have over the process.
It seems like alternating narrators is a really popular thing in YA literature. A lot of times, I don't know, just going back and forth, either like if it's a romance between one character and the other sweetheart, or sometimes it's between, you know, a sister and brother, and sometimes it's between somebody in a different era, and I don't know why it's come to be very appealing for teen readers to digest.
I'm not sure. I mean, it keeps things interesting for sure, to go back and forth between narrators. I mean, I think of Jandy Nelson's I'll Give You the Sun, which is one of my favorite YAs, and they're twin brothers, a twin brother and sister, and they, not only is it alternating narrators, but it's also different time periods. We get one, the story when the siblings are younger, and one when they're older, and we have to figure out, you know, how they got from one place to the next, and it's a really complicated, that one especially is a very complicated structure.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. If you, YA books are kind of known for being edgier and bolder and more boundary breaking than even adult literature. And you know, it seems like in YA is where people are dealing with these really gritty things like teen suicide or police brutality or sexual assault or eating disorders or you know, homelessness, all sorts of things, and it's it must be interesting as an author to try, if you're going to get into any of those topics, to do it in a way that's always going to be true to a story and not be preachy or judgy or just like, oh, this is an issue book. I mean, do those things fly by through your head? I mean, I know that your stories are very personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that YA is a really brave, like, YA books tend to be very brave in the way that they look at the world. I think that there was a time when a lot of YA books were kind of sensational in the way that they chose to approach their subjects, but I think that time has really ended. I mean, there are so many incredible writers telling stories for teenagers, and they are not afraid to tackle what's going on in the world and tackle these issues that we're reading about on the news or experiencing in our communities. And teenagers are really honest in the way that they're talking. I mean, I'm thinking about when that classmate of mine died, and we, like, it was the teenagers sitting around trying to talk to each other and make sense of it, and the adults were too afraid to talk to us about it. And so I think that writing books that address these topics that teenagers are not afraid to ask about or talk about is a really powerful thing, and that they're reading, that teenagers are choosing those books to read is what makes the YA bestseller list such a dynamic, diverse list in comparison to the adult hardcover bestseller mm-hmm. list, which is certainly not caught up in terms of reflecting diverse voices and tackling mm-hmm. a bunch of issues that are really important in our world and that we need to look at.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of a book that you wish that you'd had when you were a teen?
Let's see. I mean, a book that I wish that I had. I keep thinking, I mean, I just mentioned The Sky is Everywhere. No, I'll Give You the Sun by Jandy Nelson, but I'll say that one again. There's a reason that book always comes to mind for me, and I think it's because it... is a book that's so expansive in terms of just a human experience. It's the story of this family who have been torn apart by various things. lots of secrets, lots of jealousies, and also has such incredible love. And I think that reading that book kind of expanded my idea of... the way that people can love each other so much and yet betray each other or make these horrible mistakes and ultimately be forgiven. And I just think that any book that kind of does that to a person and makes them realize, like, oh, we all make these mistakes, we all let people down. And like, love comes in so many different forms, and at the end of the day, like, is the most important thing. I think that's just should be required reading for everybody.
Mm. Did you have someone who was your greatest influence as a writer?
Well, I mentioned Raymond Carver. He was certainly someone I read a ton of. And then also Joan Didion. I read her essays, and I read them over and over again. And her essay on keeping a notebook was really interesting to me. And I think it's because it made me feel really smart to read it. I remember reading it for the first time as a senior in high school. And I was doing some sort of program where I would go into San Francisco, and I met with this woman named Cowie, who was this, like, great poet. And she gave me a photocopied version of that essay to read. And it was about kind of observing your world and finding, like, in it, Joan Didion, like, finds old notes that she wrote to herself or wrote, like, I know there's one where she's, like, sitting at the bar in some hotel, and she makes a note of some people's clothing, and then she can't remember why she wrote it or who those people were, and then she suddenly does remember, but it's not important who they were. What's important is who she was when she was sitting there writing that and, like, reconnecting with that past self. And also, like, one of her essays begins, or very close in the beginning, she writes, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live." And I remember really thinking about that and what that means. And it was just such a, like, intellectual experience to read that, to read her work. And it's really complicated and inspiring and you know, they still resonate with me a lot today.
Mm. Can you tell us anything about what your new project is?
I'm very secretive with my works in progress. I will say, so the YA that I'm working on right now is another California story, but it takes place, I'll tell you the setting, which is it takes place more in the Mendocino area. Mm. It's like a very atmospheric, foggy flower farm is where it takes place, and lots of like rocky coastline and a mysterious feeling to it.
I see good write-offs for your taxes for
exactly,
weekends
yes,
up there.
We were just planning that. Yes, that's definitely one of the pros of novel research. I get to go stay in great places.
And then you're also working on your adult one?
Yes, I'm working on the adult one, which is It began as a multi-generational story. It still kind of is, but it surprised me as ending up being about this pair of sisters. That's what I'm most interested in right now about the story. It has morphed so many times, like in so many ways, because I've been writing it for so long. But I finally do have a story that's emerging from it. And so, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm working on that too.
Do you think you would ever try a genre piece like some of these YA writers that now have been signed up to do a Marvel story or, you know, a sci-fi or a fantasy or a something that's not their normal thing?
You know, I would have to be like a sci-fi or a fantasy reader in order to feel like I could do that. And I've never gravitated that way. It's not to say that I've never enjoyed sci-fi or fantasy novels, because I have, but it's just not where I go when I'm, you know, mm-hmm. when I pick up a book. So I don't think I would do that. The Marvel thing is really fun and interesting. And I will say that in teaching, I've been reading more graphic novels and that they've been really fun to read. And so I would certainly be open to doing a project like that with an artist mm-hmm. down the road at some point.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, even though we're a little early, I think I'm going to open it up to questions, because you're so succinct with your answer. Uh-oh. I've kind of run out of questions. Darn you.
I'll go on and on okay. If you ask me, I promise.
So, does anybody have some questions for Nina? Do we have a microphone, or do we not need one? From our... Is there a...
There's not a mic. You could use one of yours, or if you guys just want to speak up a little bit.
Okay. Okay.
Sure. Yeah, I want to make sure I'm understanding the first part of your question, the success element of it. Are you saying what happens when there are different, like people are achieving things faster or more slowly than others? Yeah. I mean, writing is a very, it's really difficult. I everybody in my writing group writes beautiful work. And it's also a business, and sometimes, you know, people really struggle, and there are dry spells when people aren't getting published, and that can be really, really tough. But I think that we have been meeting together for so long, we have all had successes in different ways, and part of our job is like reminding, you know, some of us over and over again of those successes or of what you know different writers have done and different members of our group have done so beautifully. It can be hard to like hold the really good things that happen to us and keep them in our minds when then there's a period of time when like there's not that much good stuff happening. And so I think that part of our job is to be there to remind the other ones, like, remember, like, you got a Fulbright, like, you won this big award, you know, your story was nominated for this thing, or and that's, I feel like that's like a core element to our group is being that person for one another. In terms of reading novels and stuff, I mean, we'll go sometimes where we don't discuss anybody's work for like a couple months, And then we're just meeting and sharing, you know, how the process of writing is going for us, what we're working on, general life stuff, you know, what we are, you know, good news. We try to start off with good news. That's kind of the only structure that we have. And because we found that there is a lot of just kind of talking about what's not going well or how stuck we feel or how we haven't been able to write or whatever. And so we try to begin with something positive. And then, and then we just talk. And then when one of us does have something to submit, we'll usually submit a whole novel. So like I this book that I'm working on right now, they haven't read any of it. And I tend to like it that way. I used to submit just a couple chapters at a time. But the last couple novels that I've written, I've realized for myself that's not that helpful for me. I kind of like to feel it all out for myself first and then give them the whole thing. And but you know, that's not the case with some of us. But one of my writing group members, I think we've read maybe 11 drafts of her novel, which is an amazing novel and has changed so much like over the years. And we keep reading it and reading it and reading it, and like that's really great too. And it's cool because every time it's exciting to read it because I know it so intimately, and then I see how something has changed. And and so it really, we just kind of like do whatever. And then sometimes a couple members will write more short form things like essays that they'll send out. One is a poet and essayist. And so sometimes she'll say, hey, like this, you know, website, like this online journal just asked me to submit something. Like, do you guys have a little bit of time? And she'll send something and we'll just read it and then just email. Have like a group email about it. So we're pretty flexible and adaptable, and that's just kind of, that's come from just meeting for so many years and knowing each other so well. Yeah. That was long, right?
That was very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
If so, what was the very last part?
Oh, if so, like, what do you say then?
What do I say? Yeah, I mean, there's no secret that that people don't appreciate YA the way that they appreciate books for adults. One of the, like, supreme pleasures of doing the teaching work that I do is that I teach for Hamline University, which is in St. Paul, Minnesota. They have a low residency master's program. And so that model works where the faculty, we live all over the country. The students live all over the country. We all meet twice a year for residency. So there's summer residency and winter. And we have really in-depth workshops during that time and tons of lectures. And then everybody goes home, and I'm assigned between 3 and 5 students. And I work with them one-on-one on their novels throughout the course of the semester. And so, but being there at that residency, because it's a master's program only for children and adolescent literature, is the most amazing experience, because we have incredible faculty and everybody, and like just like the smartest people I am ever able to talk to, like people with PhDs in children's literature who have read just like the whole history of children's literature, like it's, and love it and breathe it, and it's really incredible. And so to be like immersed in those residencies is like, I'm with my people, you know. We don't have to justify why we're not writing adult literary fiction. But I wish that I had a transcript of this, because I've only heard about it, but Jason Reynolds just won the LA Times Book Prize for his YA novel, A Long Way Down. And apparently, and I could be getting this wrong because it's been filtered through somebody, but apparently he stood up and told everybody who was gathered there, including all of the like adult and nonfiction writers who had also won the prizes, he basically said, like, you guys need to respect us because we're making your readers for you. Like, we're the ones who are making people read, and then they're going to become adults and they're going to read your books. But like, we are doing that work for you. And I love that. So I want to find an exact quote, and then I can just borrow that and use it. But I think one thing that's just really great to think about, is like we all have these books that we read in our childhoods that shape us so much more than adult novels shape us. You know, like I think that all of us can remember like a picture book or a middle grade novel or a YA novel, something that we read when we were like young and open to the world and like first experiencing, like seeing aspects of humanity reflected in a book that has stayed with us forever. And so I think, you know, just thinking about that makes me feel great about writing for any age.
That's a really great book, by the way, Jason Reynolds' book, yeah. Long Way Down. He, I don't know if you know it, but it's a kid who, his brother was killed in gun violence, and he decides that he thinks he knows who did it, and they live in an apartment in New York, and he's going to take his brother's gun, go down on the elevator and go out and find and take revenge on the people that killed his brother. And during the 60 seconds that it, the whole novel is him, the 60 seconds it takes for him to get down in that elevator, and during that elevator ride, meeting all these ghosts of people in his life who have been killed from gun violence and having conversations with those ghosts. It's just an amazing piece. And it's a novel in verse, so it's very spare words on the page.
Yeah, and it's won like a million awards this year. It's really swept up.
Yeah, it's nice to see him get that recognition. I mean, he's an award-winning guy anyway, but really good. Another question for Nina? Yes?
Every character is different. Usually it's more internal, and I usually don't know what they look like in the beginning, and I have to kind of figure it out. And I really dislike writing physical description, and so I tend to like save it for the next draft. But sometimes like supporting characters just kind of appear as these like fully formed gifts into the manuscript, and that's always really special when that happens. And there have been very few of them who have appeared that way, but I always really like it when they do. But I just, yeah, I really dislike writing the way that people look. It's just like not interesting to me at all, unless there's something very interesting about the way a character, unless like the appearance is very striking or something. But I have no interest in it. And I think for We Are Okay, my latest book, I think I did write the whole draft without talking about the way that the main character looked at all, and then had to go back in and add a couple little details just so that, you know, people who are looking for that and who need a little physical description to ground themselves in a story didn't lose their minds over my lack of it. Mm-hmm. Either titles come to me immediately or they're exceptionally difficult. So Hold Still, my first book, we did not have a title. It actually went out on sub with no title to editors. And then we had to come up with that one. And then, let's see, The Disenchantments had one immediately, and that was easy. It's the name of the band in the book, so that was kind of a no-brainer. And then Everything Leads to You, I feel like that one came to me towards the end of writing the book. Like, it was a line from the book, and I thought, oh, that would be a good title for this one. And then We Are Okay was actually Ocean Beach, and I was sure that it was going to be Ocean Beach. And there are lots of reasons for that. And if you've read the book, then you know, like, one of my writing group members, after reading it, said, basically everything important that happens in the book is somehow related to Ocean Beach. Like, it really is a perfect title for the book, but my editorial team at Penguin decided it was too quiet and that it didn't convey any emotion or like tell a reader anything about the book, really. And that also, which is a great point, there are ocean beaches all over the place. It's not even specific to San Francisco. And people like have their own associations with that. And so we went through a lot of different titles for We Are Okay before settling on that one.
The cover art for We Are Okay is amazing. Were there various drafts and various ideas for that, or did the one that got developed that was immediately accepted?
Yeah, I love that cover so much. I didn't know anything about it, and they had commissioned a Brazilian artist who they found on Instagram to do something for it. And I didn't know that even. And then I just got the file with the cover images. I got an email from Julie that said, you know, cover. And I, you know, held my breath and opened it up, because when it's wrong, it's just like really crushing. And there were two options, that one and then one other, and they were both amazing. And I started to cry, and I was like, it's perfect. And I just got really, really lucky with that.
Have you had other experiences where you were, I mean, it sounds like you've had other ones where they said, okay, here's the cover, and you went, no.
Yes, absolutely.
Anything you'd like to share?
Sure. I mean, I'll preface this by saying that, you know, it's a difficult job to decide what should be on a book cover, and I have really talented people working on the books, but they publish so many books every year, and they all need to look different, and they all need to be, you know, they should be unique to the story in some way. So it's challenging. But that said, I had a cover for Everything Leads to You that was just so wrong. I still like sometimes think about it and am just in shock that anyone thought it was a good idea. And that book is like my Hollywood romance. It's like my most like, I don't know, like it's definitely my most romantic book, and it's just has so much that you could do. But my protagonist is a production designer, aspiring production designer, and she spends a lot of the book searching for the perfect green couch. And then she finds it, and it's like this gorgeous couch that's out of a fairy tale. And then I like opened the file for this one, and it was this like hideous mini green couch with this horrible brown pillow on it and a giant hand like arranging the pillow on the sofa. And I was just like, first of all, she's a production designer for movies. She doesn't do miniatures. And then like, why is this horrible sofa here? Oh, and the funniest thing was it was like a stock photo that they had found, but the hand was wearing a wedding ring. And I was like, my character is like 18. And definitely not married. And they said they would like Photoshop the ring out, but we had to fight really hard to get it changed.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a big battle.
Thank you for saving the world from that couch.
Yes, you're very welcome.
Yes? Okay. Oh, okay. You don't have a question. Anyone else have a hand up that's a question? Scratching of the nose, perhaps? Can't release you yet, Kenneth.
That was the 5-minute warning.
Right. Anything you want to tell your public? When's your next book come out? Do you know?
I don't know.
Because you're still writing it.
Yeah.
Okay. So people might have to wait a couple years.
I have no idea. My Jandy Nelson and I have a pact. We're both trying to finish by a certain date that's coming up. So it just depends on, you know, how quickly Julie decides to read it and when she wants to get it on the production schedule. I can tell a little bit about that because that's kind of interesting. Like editors, you know, are in charge of a group of novels that come out each season. And so it's really you know, they have to really be very careful with how they group certain books and when they choose to release them. And so books can be held for a while if they think that they wouldn't stand out in a certain group, or if they think they would compete directly with something, or they can be sped up if it seems like things would work really well together to come out in one season. And it's really like a smart business thing because books compete for funds from the publisher, who's going to get sent on tour, who's going to get a big, you know, ad in magazines or something like that. And then they can also be used together. Like I had a season when The Disenchantments came out, close to when one of Gail Forman's books came out and one of Stephanie Perkins' books came out. And so they sent us on this book tour together so they can choose to, you know, bundle authors that way and use, you know, try to tap into their different fan bases in order to have a successful tour. So it's always, it's not really reliant upon like when you get that finished manuscript in. It's really based on, you know, marketing and publicity and all of that as well.
Yeah. Are you doing any promotion around the various anthologies that are coming out?
I have not been. In New York, they often, you know, there are so many YA authors there, and that's where the publishers are. And so there have been some launch parties planned for like New York parties, for example, but I haven't done much. For Summer Days and Summer Nights, the one that Stephanie Perkins edited, we got to do a couple events. I went to LA and got to do one with Brandi Colbert, who has a story in that too. But I haven't heard much about the other ones.
Okay. Yeah. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, I learn from the process so much. Like, because I'm reading these novels and I'm trying to figure out how, like, what's working and what's not working and why and how can I explain that? And in so doing, like, I'm teaching myself at the same time as much as I'm teaching them. And when I'm seeing things working, I'm absolutely looking at, like, what's making that work and, like, how are they doing that? And again, I have to figure out how to tell them what they're doing works because, you know, we don't always know. And it's the same for me. Like, people will read my book and make some sort of comments and, tell me something that worked. And I'll think, oh, I didn't even know I was doing that, you know. And so it's cool to be able to see, you know, in your own work and to be able to explain to another person, you know, what's making all of this tick and, you know, how could it tick better?
You know, this is just a little side note, but I edit people's novels as a little side gig.
Yeah.
And I have this one friend who was unaware, when I turned back his manuscript, he was unaware that every time there was a chance to put in a color of something, you know, I walked in the room and it was a blue couch or there was a blue lamp or whatever thing. Then every time there was one of those opportunities, he had made the thing blue.
Oh, funny. Yeah.
And amazing. And so then I started, I actually made a list and he had like 42 of these things, you know. And he said, oh, and I said, you know, and he said it was not intentional. And he said, thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, that's so cool. I mean, that's a really unique one. I like that one a lot. Like, one thing that I found is that writers tend to know, like, what words we overuse. And that can also be something to do for the revision. You know, like, if you find out that you use this one word, do a search for it and try to swap it out with other things when you can.
All right, well, I guess we will wrap this up. And once again, you can get books signed by Nina outside to the left as you exit the building. And thank you so much for coming to the festival and to coming here.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Regan. This was so fun.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.